Welcome back to Russian Roulette, the podcast from the Russia and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm your host, Olga Oleker, here in the CSIS studio with my co-host, Jeff Mankoff.
Hello, hello.
This is a particularly revolutionary episode of Russian Roulette.
In all senses of the word.
I mean, we're always a little revolutionary. If you're listening to this, it's November 6th, 2017 or later. And back on November 7th, 1917, the Bolsheviks took power
in the great October Socialist Revolution.
Which was, of course, October then, but November later.
Because the Bolsheviks were still using the Gregorian, or the Russians were still using the Gregorian calendar.
Well, the Bolsheviks, too, being Russian.
Shortly after taking power, they shifted over to the Julian calendar and joined the Western schedule, I suppose.
So here's what we're going to do with this episode.
First, I'm going to sit down for a conversation with Melissa Stockdale, who is the Brian and Sandra O'Brien Presidential Professor of History at the University of Oklahoma, where she's a specialist in modern Russian history, and perhaps most important, my former professor, one of the people who got me interested in Russia in the first place.
That's very important.
Yeah.
And revolutionary.
Well, perhaps for me it was. But Melissa and I are going to talk about why Russia never became a liberal state, despite occasional waves of liberalism, about the 1990s and how they led to the rise of Vladimir Putin, but also lessons from 1917, how Russia's relationship with the outside world, both then and later, shaped its internal political trajectory. And then we're going to talk about Russian identity and patriotism during and after the First World War and the Great October Socialist Revolution.
And then after that, Jeff and I will dig a little deeper into 1917 and what it means in 2017.
Yeah, so let's get started. I'm here in the studio with Melissa Stockdale, who is the Brian and Sandra O'Brien Presidential Professor of History at the University of Oklahoma. She's a specialist on modern Russian history and has published widely on everything from Russian national identity, patriotism, liberalism, the First World War, and a range of other things. And we're going to have hopefully a wide-ranging and informative discussion here today. So, Melissa, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Jeff. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So I guess one of the big questions about Russian history, if you kind of step back and view it from 30,000 feet, is why the liberal version has never really triumphed or has only triumphed in very brief periods. How come there hasn't really been a liberal Russia?
Wow, that's a good question. I'll have to say that when I wrote my first book about the prominent liberal Paul Miliukov, I was finishing that book up in the 1990s, and a topic that had seemed arcane had suddenly become incredibly relevant because they were having a sort of liberal interlude. The Soviet Union collapsed. Boris Yeltsin was presiding over the sort of inchoate democracy that was forming. People were enjoying the right to speak and gather and publish. And there was a sort of heady sense of that freedom and possibility, which played out against a backdrop of economic implosion and really terrible times for ordinary people. And it seemed like they'd kind of gotten through some of the roughest patches by the late 90s, and that when Putin took over, that he was perhaps going to preside over a continuing democratic, parliamentary, and in some respects, liberal regime. And of course, we know it went in a completely different direction. And I know many of my Russian friends were shocked and horrified that that was the case. They sort of said, if we made it through 1998 without going to pieces, why, when it's getting better and oil prices are going up, that it seems like, why can't we keep going?
So what happened? I mean, why was this the one of the many turning points, I guess, when Russian history failed to turn?
One of the many turning points. You know, we all know about the rise of the Russian mafia and oligarchs, and I think it's hard for Americans to appreciate the depth of lack of law and order, the fact that it was so arbitrary and capricious, an independent judiciary was not very well established. And it was really the case that somebody could just show up at your door and demand menace money, and you had no redress anywhere. And that left people feeling very frightened and nervous. There's obviously the terrorism that helped bring Putin to power, you know, the incident with the apartment bombings in Moscow and believing that Chechen terrorists were responsible, which may or may not have been the case. I was in Moscow in 2002 when they had that horrible hostage-taking event at a theater in downtown Moscow, and over 100 people died as they tried to liberate those captives. Mm-hmm. So I guess the lack of law and order, the ongoing problems with corruption, and above all, how bad the economic implosion was of the 1990s, is that when Putin came to power and was sort of saying, let me gather back, you know, the plenitude of power from the regions, from below, and sideline oligarchs, and, you know, we'll have one strong, firm leader. And that coincided with an oil boom that was restoring their economy, that seems like a lot of people said, yes.
So some of this was just bad timing then. You know, maybe had the liberal wave that crashed over Russia in the late 1980s and early 1990s not coincided with all of the upheavals that ensued, maybe this turning point would have turned out differently. Because, you know, like you said, your first book was about Paul Milyukov and the quest for liberal Russia around the time of the First World War. And that was another one of these moments where Russia came to a turning point and in a lot of ways failed to turn. So are there – do you see similarities? Are there lessons from how things played out after 1917, 1918 that might be relevant today?
Well, the obviously biggest difference between 1917, sort of lost opportunity, and what happened after the collapse of the Soviet Union was that Russia was involved in a total war in 1917. And that's never a good time to transition from fairly absolutist monarchical rule to a pretty freewheeling democracy. And that was not the case with the peaceful end of the Cold War, which it's still a miracle that it happened so peacefully. Mm-hmm. And then trying to make that transition in 1991. But more and more, I've come to believe that the economic implosion, because the Russian economy was completely unraveling, that's what provoked the February Revolution. It was food shortages in the capital city. Right. And people had sort of had it with waiting in line for bread and not even knowing if they would get enough to feed their family for a day. Women rioted, strikers joined. Yeah. Pretty soon the garrison is on board and a regime is toppled. And that economic unraveling intensified with the loss of the traditional monarchic authority and a new temporary government set in place. And
so trying to do reform in the economy and the social fabric are coming apart is always going to be difficult.
And I think that while we don't want to reduce it to it's the economy, stupid, is that oftentimes when things are so terrifying, when too much is changing too fast, and economically things are visibly getting worse and worse and more frightening, it's very easy for people to embrace an idea that's being presented to them that it's like you can have freedom or you can have security. Mm-hmm. It becomes this false either-or choice. And that's sure what that's what I saw after Putin came to power. And the more I research in what was going on in 1917, the more it seems like people are saying, we just want there to be security.
Now, obviously, it's a bit of a counterfactual, but assuming that the circumstances had been different, I mean, to what extent was the infrastructure in place, the intellectual, political, social infrastructure in place for this kind of a liberal transition. I mean, you know, Paul Milyukov was a liberal reformer, a member of the Russian Duma before and during the First World War. You know, he was part of a group of people who were putting forward ideas for what a liberal Russia could look like. You know, under different circumstances, do you think they would have had a chance to succeed?
I am probably one of a very tiny handful of over-optimistic people who believe that if this transition had not occurred in the midst of war, they could have. I think that during the Cold War, the question we used to ask about the Russian Revolution was, did World War I speed up the inevitability or slow down the inevitable revolution? And once the Cold War was over and we were no longer worried about legitimacy of the Bolshevik regime and people went back, they stopped looking at the late imperial period as a prelude to a revolution. And they started looking at it as an ongoing project of governance, of economic reform. And late imperial Russia was an incredibly dynamic place. They had a growing civil society, an associational sphere, a booming economy that was running about 7% annual growth. Who wouldn't like that? I mean, there were a lot of ingredients for them to have made that transition, except, of course, that they had a monarch who was never going to do it voluntarily. It took a war.
Yeah. You know, the geopolitical context of both the period around 1917 and the more recent one is important in some ways too, right? Because the regimes that succeeded the ones that fell in both of these periods really found themselves in kind of a confrontational relationship with a lot of the outside world. They fell back on this metaphor of Russia as a besieged fortress, as a means of consolidating power domestically. So, you know, how does Russia's relationship with the outside world, with the other major powers, how has that shaped the sort of political trajectory that the country has followed in both of these periods?
I think that's a great question. One of the things that my research for my book suggests, and which reinforces what, among other historians, Eric Lohr here at
we
American
also had
University.
On the podcast at
okay,
some point.
Well, Eric studied the sort of growing economic nationalism in Russia on the eve of the war and then during the war, and some of the stuff that I've done on public mobilization and public opinion campaigns would reinforce the sense that there was a very widespread resentment, not just among elites, but among common people, of foreign economic interference. And the word they used was zasilia, domination, foreign domination. And they especially identified that with Germany, because there was a lot of German investment and everything. And that was something that you could mobilize popular resentment, antipathy, and nationalists did that very effectively. And then the war really galvanized it to support very radical anti-German type things.
So this Zasilio was identified with Germans even before the First World War.
Yes, exactly. And then it became ever so much more so when you got the nationalist press banging the drum about, you know, German domination and German spies and German.
And Tsarina Alexandra is a German agent.
Right. And they very effectively evoked this whole thing, not just that the Germans are like taking advantage of our broad Russian nature, but they said, Germans despise us. They look down on us. They think they're better than – German arrogance was a big theme too. And I certainly think you could dial forward and say that one of the things that Putin – he didn't create it. He tapped into it – was resentment of foreign penetration of the market, you know, like Russian goods disappeared in the 1990s and were replaced by European and to some degree American goods. It seemed like – what's ours is gone. It's been driven out by these new, more expensive products and the investment and the feeling that people were losing their jobs as, you know, businesses were closed or whatever. And there was a very, very strong backlash and resentment against that foreign economic, not just influence, but dominance, and the related resentment of saying, They look down on us. They think they're better than us. They think we're backward.
Mm-hmm.
And that was powerful, and he played that beautifully.
Yeah, and I think, again, you see echoes of this today. You know, I remember going to Russia shortly after the Sochi Olympics, which was supposed to be kind of a coming out party for Russia on the world stage. And the way that it was covered in the international press was seen by a lot of Russians as being sort of humiliating.
That exactly. All the talk about how the toilets worked and stuff. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's like, you know, this was the great show that we were putting on for you. And this is, you know, this was the backlash that we got. It fed into that sort of nationalist backlash, which, you know, you saw in the invasion of Crimea, which happened, mm-hmm. you know, not too long afterwards. So your new book is called Mobilizing the Russian Nation, Patriotism and Citizenship in the First World Wars. So let's talk about Russian patriotism and identity a little bit, you know, both in the context of the First World War, mm-hmm. but also, again, how that is relevant for the Russia that we're dealing with today. How did the First World War affect Russian identity, notions of citizenship or patriotism?
I believe that it had a really profound effect on both of those. There was a wide assumption in scholarly literature for a long time that one of the reasons that Russia alone of the great powers could not sustain the fight to the end was that they were insufficiently developed as a nation, that it was a country of peasants, that they did not imagine themselves belonging to a shared political community, that the old, you know, sort of adage was a peasant from Tambov knows he's from Tambov and he will fight for Tambov to the end.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of Russia is foreign to him.
Mm-hmm.
And in my previous book, looking at World War I, it had seemed to me that people were pretty patriotic and that was not merely a sort of urban and an elite phenomenon. But I thought, well, who knows? So I started looking into it and I became convinced that a sense of a Russian national identity was much more broadly mm-hmm. diffused in the population and in the rural population, and that our sort of imaginary peasant from Tambov was really not a very accurate thing.
Mm-hmm.
Moreover, we can look at what happened in, you know, like all of the combatant countries that, when you're fighting a war that is a total war, that is starting to look like an existential war.
Right.
Especially once
a lot of the Russian Empire's territory gets occupied.
Yes. It ratchets up even more so your sense that you belong to a community, a mm-hmm. meaningful national community,
mm-hmm.
That you have to resist and defend these would-be aggressors or invaders. And the Russians, just like everybody else, said, we were the innocent party here.
Sure.
In
the popular story about 1914, and this is mostly taken from accounts in Britain and Germany
mm-hmm.
And France to some degree, was that when war was declared, people were eager to go off and mm-hmm. fight, that they were, you know, the people were going out and waving to the troop trains that mm-hmm. were moving off to the front, and that there was this real kind of enthusiasm for this, you know, struggle to show the national greatness. Did you see something similar in Russia?
Yes. Absolutely. And scholars have slightly complicated that whole picture where
yes.
we know that, yes, there was once the war happened, a number of people said, yep, our cause is just, we're going to win, it's going to be good, we're going to show them. But that we now know that for the great, more silent majority, which was mostly peasants and farmers, that they were going, oh my God, it's harvest time. Could there have been a more terrible time for this to happen?
Mm-hmm.
And they were more resigned, perhaps, than feeling gung-ho patriotic.
Yeah.
But the story has been that whereas French peasants or German farmers or English farmers understood what this was about and that mm-hmm. they had to go, you know, fight for their homeland
for the king
or whatever.
The Kaiser
yeah,
or
exactly.
Whatever.
That the Russian peasants were going, hey, they're never going to make it to Tambov. I don't see the point of this.
Mm-hmm.
And my research suggests that that was not true. And it's really, you know, it's interesting how you try to puzzle that out. And one of the ways that we know how peasants felt, or we can get at it, is that the Tsarist secret police were busy watching and reading letters and everything, and they're opening them up. And there, I read dozens and dozens and dozens of letters in the archives in Moscow where some girl who's in Tambov or some young man in Siberia is writing to his friend or relative somewhere else and saying, this is how mobilization went here. People were pretty good about it. Yeah. We didn't have disorders. We didn't have protests. You know, people are solid behind this. And so these are all these not written for publication eyewitness testimonies that are coming in. There's a couple of rare peasant diaries, but obviously you don't.
Most
so you start
literate.
Believing that actually a very large percentage of the population, even the rural population, and even the ethnically non-Russian population.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is did you see variation in terms of the willingness of people to fight once you go from, say, I don't know, Tambov to Chernigov or to, you know,
Riga,
Warsaw.
Or,
exactly.
Yeah. They also had smooth mobilization in those areas, which was would be like a contrast for when you were mobilizing for the Russo-Japanese War in 1904 and 1905, where you had a lot of evasion and draft resistance and draft riots and so on. But I think that was where something that's interesting comes in, is that even as war is horrible and fearful and a burden, war is also an opportunity. And for people who are sort of like second or third class citizens, it is an opportunity to show that you are patriotic, that you're a member of the community, that you will go out and fight and do your duty. And then you hope when you come back from that service that you can sort of present your claim for greater citizenship rights or
we
fuller
sacrificed.
Inclusion.
We should be represented.
You know, and I think that a good comparison would be if you look at the African-American experience in the United States when, you know, war was declared in 1917, there was kind of a split in the African-American community. Some people said, why should we go fight this war for this country that's treating us so poorly? But there was a significant part of the African-American committee who said, okay, here's our chance. It's our chance to show that we are worthy of citizenship, we are worthy of rights, and that we are men. We can go out and do a man's job. And of course, that's not how it played out for them. But you can find Poles and Finns and Muslims in the Russian Empire, their community leaders are making speeches and writing each other letters saying, this is our chance. This is our chance.
I know the biggest example of backlash against mobilization in the Russian Empire actually was in Central Asia among Kazakhs and Kyrgyz in 1916. That led to essentially an open rebellion. So, you know, I think in a sense, maybe that indicates the extent to which people in that part of the Russian Empire didn't really even see themselves as being part of the Russian Empire. Like, this was somebody else's war that they were being called on.
And I think that's totally true. If you look at, like, the Muslim population in along the Volga or in, you know, part of what would be present-day Tatarstan, they were totally fine with it, and their elites were really sure that they were going to win significant concessions for their participation. But in Central Asia, which was much more truly a colonial outpost, it was – I don't think that the imperial state imagined it as part of the nation, and I don't think the population did. They were much more left to their own devices. They had not ever been subject to conscription the way Muslims elsewhere were. And of course, being conscripted into a national army is a very nationalizing experience. So when they decided that they had these terrible labor shortages and they were going to conscript this draft-exempt population for labor, so you don't even get kind of get the pride and manhood of being conscripted to be a warrior. It's like you're going to go out and be a porter or dig ditches. They sort of said, not a chance, no.
Yeah, and these are also, in a lot of cases, nomadic populations. This is before they'd been forced
and
to
they did a terrible job. Whereas the 1914 mobilization had been really carried out incredibly effectively, they just sort of you know, hacked together this labor conscription thing, ran it through the Council of Ministers with a couple people going, wait a minute, we should think about this more. And it was implemented poorly. The population hadn't been prepared for it. And it was a disaster. It was a disaster.
Yeah. So leaving aside the Central Asians, on the part of Poles and Jews and Balts and others, there was a willingness to fight. And did that affect the way that the state approached them, their sort of sense of belonging in this Russian nation, whatever it was going to look like?
It absolutely did. I mean, from the very, very start, the sort of narratives that were crafted by the by government agencies, in the press, by, you know, this civic society. They called it sacred union. You know, they borrowed the French term.
Right.
And they said, it is a sacred union of all the nation, all her sons and daughters. And they said, the mighty and the humble.
Mm-hmm. And by nation, they meant all the subjects of the Tsar.
Yeah, all the subjects of the Tsar. And they said, it's rural, it's urban. It is every nationality. They said, there is no Hellene and no Jew. We are all ardent sons of our great mother, Russia. And you can't, like, find somebody who said, let's go with this story or whatever. It just sort of popped up right away. And we see similar stories coming from the other combatant nations,
sure,
where class differences are forgotten. You know, we're all united. We love our country. We will defend our just cause. And posters represent that. Pamphlets are going to be written and sent out to represent that. It's going to be written up in newspapers. And I think people really embraced the idea that this was a much more inclusive vision of the nation.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't ethnically great Russian. It wasn't only Orthodox people. It left a space for Jews and Muslims and Protestants and everything else. And again, by buying into that, embracing it, performing your patriotism by, you know, giving to war relief or volunteering to nurse or whatever, besides the men who were actually sent off to fight. And ultimately, almost 18 million men were mobilized over the course of the war, which is a staggering figure, that it gave you this chance to show that you did indeed belong. And, you know, people could say, oh, well, it's just wartime rhetoric. It will all be forgotten. And we know that wartime promises are often forgotten. Mm-hmm. But I found one interesting exchange in 1915 in the Council of Ministers when a couple of national elites had come forward and said, would you be open to the idea of forming like all Polish units or all Finnish units or whatever? And the army said that they didn't feel like that was exactly the right time to do it. But the head of the, you know, the Minister of War said, however, the splendid performance of our non-Russian troops in the army who have fought shoulder to shoulder with great Russians and shown equal courage and patriotism requires that when the war is over, we completely rethink their status in the army and kind of what goes along with that. And I thought, wow, that wasn't a promise to the public. That was the head of the War Department saying, these guys have proved that they're in with us equally, they're in the fight, and we got to do something about that.
Yeah, well, there was a big argument. I actually wrote my dissertation about this, about what to do with Poland, because at the beginning of the war, there was this proclamation that the Russian Empire was going to unite all of the Polish people who at that point were divided up between Austria, Germany, and Russia, as they put it in the text, under the scepter of the Tsar.
Yeah.
But then that raised the question of, well, what basis do the Polish inhabitants of these other areas, never mind like the Russian bit of Poland, have that these promises are actually going to be fulfilled? And how can they participate not only in the military process, but also politically in such a way that they're going to have their rights guaranteed in the post-war Russian state? And there were these big fights within the Russian political apparatus, the Council of Ministers,
also
the Duma and elsewhere, about what exactly the Grand Duke, who was the commander-in-chief of the military, actually meant with this proclamation, and could it actually be fulfilled? And then you look at the intra-Polish debates, and you have a lot of Poles, especially as the war goes on, saying, you know, the Russians never intended to honor this. They don't know what they're doing. They're occupying Polish territory in Austria, and they're, you know, trying to assimilate it into Russian Orthodoxy. So why should we believe anything that they promised? And the irony is that in November of 1916, it's the Germans and the Austrians who say, who proclaim Polish independence before the Russians have a chance to do it, because they're still busy trying to sort out what it means.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So, and there were people who had a good reason to be a little bit skeptical about what this, you know, what does united under the Russian scepter exactly mean?
Yeah. Well, and then the Jews, who a lot of them lived on the front lines in the old Pale of Settlement, mm-hmm. who faced a lot of persecution from the military authorities.
Yes, they absolutely did. It's so interesting that you bring that up, because most of my book is looking at how you construct an inclusive Russian nation, you know, what the narratives are and the representations, and then what people take away from that. But necessarily, I have a chapter about the people who are excluded.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts with Poles being included, and mm-hmm. then Jews and Germans being excluded by a big part of the population. And then as the war drags on and it's becoming more and more of a hardship for more and more of the population, you start seeing that businessmen, mm-hmm. Capitalists, they are starting to be included, because they're saying profiteers.
Mm-hmm.
These are, in a war that is about sacrifice and service, they are not serving and they are not sacrificing anything.
Right.
And I believe that some of the incredible hostility we see against, like, shop owners, mm-hmm. and capitalists and so on that the Bolsheviks capitalize on, a lot of that is coming right out of the war experience.
That's interesting. Now, so there's this tension, I guess, then, between the kind of inclusive rhetoric on the one hand, and then the dynamics of wartime, where resources are limited, people's patience is tested,
mm-hmm.
People want to find a scapegoat for the suffering, and particularly for the defeat, and often they find that in, you know, people who don't look like them or don't talk like them. You know, today, if we could sort of fast forward several decades, you know, Russia is still a very multi-ethnic state. It's one that has been kind of struggling with this idea of how do we craft an inclusive ethnic identity, but that's also playing on, or has at times tried to play on, ethnic Russian nationalism and resentment as a mobilizing force. So do you see lessons from the period that you focused on in your book for the question of how to build an inclusive Russian nation today?
I think that it seems problematic today. On the one hand, we know that there's incredibly strong support for Putin, even among many non-ethnic groups in the Russian Federation. But we also know that...
non-ethnic Russian ethnic groups, I mean.
Yes. Put that badly. But we also know that Russian nationalism has become more great Russian nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
It's partly the growing influence of the Russian Orthodox Church, which Putin has really, really embraced. And they construe Russianness, I think, more mm-hmm. narrowly and with a much more religious coloration. And there are, frankly, not that many people who are Russian Orthodox who don't happen to be ethnically Russian. You have certainly tensions in places like Tatarstan, where you have, they have a degree of autonomy and control over their local affairs, but everybody's lost a lot of their autonomy and control over local affairs.
Right.
And there is, on the one hand, we talked about earlier that perceived arrogance and insensitivity of Europe and the West
mm-hmm.
has helped pull Russians together as a us versus them thing. But I have friends who are ethnically not Russian, who live in the Russian Federation, and who they see a real uptick mm-hmm. in a more ethnically, religiously, narrowly defined Russianness, and they worry about it.
Yeah. Well, one of the big differences between the Russian Federation and of today and the Russian Empire of 100 years ago is that the Russian Federation today is actually a lot more homogenous.
Yes.
It's, what, 70 or so percent mm-hmm. ethnic Russian, which means that the non-ethnic Russian population is in a lot of ways at in a more disadvantaged position relative to, you know, the Russian Empire, which was so heterogeneous that, you know, the Tsar was obviously very strongly invested in orthodoxy, but was in some ways kind of a bulwark against ethnic nationalism.
That's true. The formal census they had for the Russian Empire was in 1897, and so that's kind of the benchmark. And at that time, ethnic Great Russians were like 49%, which is part of why it made it so important for them to say there's no such thing as Ukrainians and Belarusians.
Right.
They're just variants of mm-hmm. the Great Russians, which puts you up higher.
You get a much higher number.
Yeah. And today, because those you know, borderland areas are no longer part of the Russian mm-hmm. Federation, yeah, you have a much greater preponderance of ethnically Great Russian people in the in the Russian Federation, that would have been true.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the other thing is, of course, you have the experience of the Soviet Union collapsing on ethnic mm-hmm. lines. And for, I think, Russian political leaders today, whether it's Putin or anybody else, that's a memory and a concern that they're going to be very aware of.
Yes.
And seek to prevent having repeat itself. Okay, so your book on mobilizing the Russian nation came out fairly recently. What are you working on now?
Right now, I'm finishing up a collection of readings on the Russian Revolution. Mm-hmm. It should have been out a little earlier in time for the centenary, but
we all know how the academic publishing
process works.
Yeah,
know how that goes. But it's called Debates, Aspirations, and Impacts, and I wanted to look at post-Cold War literature, mm-hmm. scholarly literature on the revolution, because I think we all agree that as long as the Cold War was casting its shadow over scholarship, the questions we asked were very colored by that.
Sure.
And so once we're, you know, well beyond that, what kind of scholarship has come out that has benefited from the opening of archives, which really is transformational? Mm-hmm. You can do a lot of things you could never do before when that stuff was not accessible to scholars. And also when you ask different questions. And so, for instance, a lot of the post 1991 scholarship on the revolution is saying, how did it play out in what is today Uzbekistan, mm-hmm. or, you know, in away from the metropole and
right.
out in the areas? And there's more attention to cultural history, like rituals and symbols and language and all of that. So, and I think that's really exciting and interesting and fresh.
Mm-hmm.
So I've gathered 15 pieces previously published, a couple by Russian scholars that have not been translated. So I translated those into English.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been interesting to see how the centennial has played out, because I think everybody was saying, how is the Putin regime going to mark or not mark mm-hmm. the Russian Revolution?
Right. I heard somebody put it recently, the first colored revolution was red.
Yes, that is a great way to put it. I hadn't heard that one. But he pretty much signaled last year that he considered the Russian Revolution to have been not a good thing mm-hmm. for Russia, and that it was not something they were going to make a big deal out of. Well, the state is not doing much, but Russian scholars and institutions have. They've had some fantastic exhibits to do with the revolution and some of the big art museums and scholarly centers. There's been some very, very interesting conferences that mm-hmm. have been put on by Russian universities or
yeah.
scholarly think tanks. But for sure, it would be such a different way of celebrating than it would have been, say, like in 1967 when they had the big 50th anniversary. Mm-hmm. The way that was marked in Russia was it was giant.
Yeah.
It was celebrating,
right. It was
this
epochal event, not only in Russian history.
Yeah,
but
it was
history.
The foundation event and on and on and on. And now we have a regime that says, it was regrettable that it happened, and let's not talk about it.
Yeah. Well, we talked about this with Eric Lohr when he was here, about the ambiguity in the way that the modern Russian state mm-hmm. chooses to remember 1917 and the way that it tries almost to reconcile the diverging perspectives of red and white, which, you know, it's like oil and water.
Yes. Yes. So, yeah, that has been interesting. There was something that I thought was super interesting that was done by a Russian scholar, a Professor Kalashnikov, in cooperation with Alex Rabinowitz, who's an American eminent American historian of Russia. And they put together a questionnaire on like the February Revolution, the degree to like, do you think it was inevitable this was going to happen? How much do you think the war influenced it? What do you think were the biggest mistakes that were made by the new provisional government? Do you think that a democratic outcome was possible, or was it going to end up authoritarian one way or another?
Yeah.
And they circulated that, and they got 40 Western and Russian scholars to fill it out, and they collated it and put it all together. And it was very interesting, the almost uniformly not optimistic reading, that it was not going to turn out well. It was, even if they made mistakes, it was still not going to turn out well if they'd made no mistakes. And it was fascinating.
Мы хотели, так лучше получилось, как всегда.
Yes,
which I think explains most things in Russian history. We wanted the best, but it turned out the way that it always does. Melissa, thanks so much for being with us
today. Thanks so much. It was just a pleasure, Jeff.
So, the Russian Revolution. We've already had a few episodes that touched on aspects of the Russian Revolution because, well,
it's
it was
1917.
It was
2017.
It's 2017, and the revolution was a multi-stage process, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, back in February, we talked with Eric Lohr about the February Revolution, the prelude to October, and you just heard our conversation with Melissa Stockdale, where we dove more into the Bolshevik Revolution and the process that led to the Russian Civil War.
I mean, it's an interesting thing how much attention we pay to the Russian Revolution as a revolution. There's a premise, I'm not sure I actually agree with this premise, but I'm going to throw it out there, that the Russian Revolution is the revolution we think about, more so than the French Revolution, which in many ways, you know, was more original. Certainly the American Revolution is a political revolution. While we talk about it this way in the United States, it was less of a break with the past in a lot of ways. But even the Chinese and Iranian revolutions, which were tremendous breaks with the past, they followed the Russian Revolution.
I mean, I would say that the French Revolution is still really the archetype that most historians and theorists of revolution point back to. But the problem with the French Revolution is it happened so long ago that it's a little bit hard sometimes, I think, for us to wrap our minds around some of the issues that were at stake. It seems a little bit remote from the present. And the Russian Revolution, even though it was 100 years ago, it still dealt with problems and themes that are fairly familiar with us. Income inequality, industrialization, ethnic identity.
Some of which came up in the French Revolution.
To some degree, but in a very different way. And I think a lot of people are still alive today who have firsthand memories not of the Russian Revolution itself, but of the aftermath of the Stalinist period, of World War II, of the stagnation and the collapse of the Soviet Union. So it's still very present in contemporary historical memory in a way that maybe the French Revolution isn't.
Though arguably we are all still living with the effects of the French Revolution.
But at such a remove that, you know, when you're asking, you know, why do countries have mass conscription armies, for example, you don't think about the fact that, well, that was how Napoleon conducted warfare at the end of the French Revolutionary period.
You know, one of the things that's striking about the Russian Revolution, right? The intent wasn't that they were going to bring communism to Russia. They were going to start building communism, right? The revolution was a process that begins with the seizure of power, not a not completed once they've seized power.
Right. Well, it wasn't supposed to be just a Russian revolution. The takeover of power by the communists in Russia was supposed to be a prelude to the outbreak of global revolution. And indeed, in the period around 1918 to 1921, you had revolutions break out in Hungary, in Bavaria, and you had the Soviet army launch an invasion of Poland, which was designed to bring the revolution to Europe.
I'm not sure that's how I read the Russo-Polish War.
Okay.
What I actually find interesting about it, but I mean, I think that's an interesting question and an interesting conversation to have, because the other reading of the Russo-Polish War is the Poles, Pilsudski, taking advantage of Russian weakness in the aftermath of the revolution, the effort to consolidate power to take over territory in Ukraine, which has been contested between the two of them. You've got this period of time where they're moving back and forth,
right?
But it's the Poles that launched the war.
Well, for the Poles, there was already a war going on. I mean, this was the part of the process of breakdown that accompanied the civil war and the collapse of Tsarist Russia.
Well, there's
Russia.
Civil war going on in Ukraine.
Yeah, and the Polish effort to take control in the west of what had been the Tsarist Empire was part of that. But that was a traditional, you know, struggle for territory. What happened, though, is that when the Bolsheviks responded, it wasn't just an effort to retake territory that had belonged to the Tsarist Empire. It was an attempt to spread the communist message, including through an invasion of Poland that was not designed to stop in Poland. It was designed to go as far as it could go.
Right, but the Poles attacked first.
Well, I don't know. I mean, everybody was fighting everybody.
Right, but the Poles had this expectation of having to fight the Red Army, and they went in with the expectation that they could overcome the Red Army. I mean,
in the territory that they were seeking to seize, but it wasn't only the Red Army they were fighting. It was the whites, it was the local nationalists, it was the anarchists, it was the Greens.
Right, which argues for why they maybe should have thought this through a bit more, but that's a separate question.
But either way, the point is that the Bolsheviks didn't see the revolution stopping at the borders of what had been the Russian Empire.
Well, I think – but this is kind of an interesting and developing process, right? Because, yes, there's this rhetoric, and you've got this November 8th, 1917 decree of peace calling on the workers of England, France, and Germany to kind of rise up. And you've got the Soviets from a very early stage financing opposition groups in Germany and Europe.
In a way, they were returning the favor, because after all, the Germans had been supporting Lenin and the Bolsheviks during the First World War as a way of subverting the power of Tsarist Russia.
But what's interesting is that they're not just trying to subvert power, the Soviets. They really do want revolution, at least initially. And I think the other thing that's interesting here is you've got the Brits and the French and the Americans who don't want the Russians to leave the war, right? And that's in some ways that motivates their interference in the civil war that follows within Russia.
Yeah.
It's more about that than the fear that the Bolsheviks are going to successfully launch a global revolution, which they have their doubts about.
Right. Well, there's lots of things going on here, right? I mean, on the one hand, at least until the fall of 1918, so a year after the Bolsheviks take power, the First World War is still going on. And yes, the British, the French, the Americans, the Japanese for that matter, are all interested in Russia's continued participation in the First World War.
Despite the fact that one of the reasons the Bolsheviks are able to take power is because everybody is so angry that Russia's still in this war.
Right. I mean, that was in a way maybe Kerensky and the provisional government's biggest mistake. Having taken power, decided to stay in the war. But now you've got this foreign intervention, which in a way, even though it was focused primarily on keeping Russia in the war, feeds into this notion among the Bolshevik leadership that the rest of the world is not going to let communism succeed, that they're going to try and, as they put it, strangle the revolution in its cradle.
Right, absolutely. And I think that actually does have longstanding repercussions, even though the Soviets fairly soon after, they have a fight about this, right? They argue, but the wing, which includes Lenin, that's basically like, let's get out of the war, let's see if we can get our house in order to some extent, is successful. And, you know, Litvinov has his peace offensive to try to get the blockades lifted, and he has
and
some
Trotsky
success.
Trotsky signs the Peace of Brest-Litovsk,
right,
which sees Russia cede huge swaths of territory, including lots of what is now Ukraine, to these semi-independent states that then, you know, become the locus for the Poles and others intervening to try and take over.
And then over time, you have the Soviet consolidation of power in what used to be the Russian Empire over a lengthy period of time. And one of the things that I think this conversation brings up is very often people talk about 1917 and October. They, especially these days, immediately think about Russia, whereas, of course, through all of the years of Soviet rule, it was much broader than Russia. Everybody got to celebrate October 1917, even if they didn't actually their country didn't actually join the Soviet Union until somewhat later.
Yeah, or even if they were forcibly conquered by the Red Army and did not of their own volition choose to participate in the revolution or the Soviet Union.
I mean, what's interesting is Soviet textbooks, even years later, would refer to Russian imperial expansion long before the Soviets as reunification.
Right.
So, you know,
the gathering of the lands.
The gathering of the lands, including, say, Turkmenistan as one of the lands, which, you know, the reunification argument's questionable. But it's, you know, I do find it sort of fascinating that where the revolution does spread, you know, at the point of a gun, is to the territory that the Russian Empire controlled.
Or some of the territory that the Russian Empire controlled, because, you know, one of the things that ends up happening is that the invasion of Poland fails. It gets right up to the gates of Warsaw before Piłsudski's forces turn it back.
Well, though you could argue also, conversely, you could argue that the Polish effort to invade Russia fails because...
No, so when World War I broke out, the bulk of what is now Poland was part of the Russian Empire. When Poland becomes independent, it's not clear where its borders are going to be. And much of the territory in what is now Belarus and Ukraine was contested between this Polish state and the successor of the Russian Empire, and also various Ukrainian governments, I should say.
Right. I mean, this is also, you know, kind of from the Ukrainian standpoint, this is this fascinating birth of the Ukrainian claim to, hey, this is our opportunity to have our own land.
Yeah. There were multiple governments that claimed to be the independent government of Ukraine, or at least parts of Ukraine, during this period. And they were fighting at different times with both the Russians and the Poles. And at the end of the day, the Poles and the Russians decide to gang up against the Ukrainians, which is an old story, I suppose. And then the Russians and Poles end up fighting it out. And that essentially ends with the Polish military under Piłsudski defeating the Russian invasion on
the
gates of Warsaw.
Counter-invasion.
And, well, it wasn't an invasion. It was
Well, it depends on how you look at it, right? It always feels like an invasion if you claim the territory, and then
I don't think it was established where, you know, Western Belarus, Western Ukraine were going to be. They started off as contested territory, you know, as soon as the Russian Empire collapsed. And this whole war was about figuring out where those territories were going to go. And at the end of the day, most of them ended up in Poland, which created lots of challenges down the road.
Kind of back to the broader point, though, it's fascinating that the revolution doesn't extend beyond the borders of Russian Empire, that it manages to consolidate within a lot of Russian Empire, most of it even, but it doesn't extend beyond it.
Yeah, well, in part because of the defeat in the Russo-Polish War, the Soviet government's attempts to use the Red Army as the sort of spear to support the revolutions that were breaking out in other parts of Europe doesn't succeed. And so the revolutions that break out in Hungary and in Bavaria are put down. They're put down by very hardline right-wing governments, which end up taking over in these countries and really setting the stage for a lot of the politics of the 20s and 30s, where you have this extreme polarization between right and left and just this kind of general breakdown in governability in a lot of these countries.
And the Soviets stop trying to export revolution all that directly and start trying to do it by just supporting some of the leftist groups around Europe more than anything else, and really around the world.
Yeah, through the Comintern.
The Comintern. It's a fascinating. We always this question of what if Kerensky had gotten out of World War One? What if they had been able to hold the provisional government together? What would that have? Would there still have been a Russo-Polish War?
Right.
Would what would have happened in Central Asia in the Caucasus? And they're counterfactual, so they didn't happen. But they're interesting questions to ask.
Yeah, I remember we talked about this back in February with Eric Lohr, and he was making the argument that the one chance for sort of the liberal revolution, Kerensky's revolution, to succeed in Russia would have been for the provisional government to get out of the war. But yet they didn't, and so this is what you ended up with instead.
Revolution.
Yeah, another one.
Another one. I think I'm also struck by the parallels. There's always parallels, right? Pick any historical period and any other historical period, you'll find your parallels.
Right.
But on the one hand, Russian efforts to subvert Western governments by supporting, in this case, only ideologically aligned left-wing groups. It's a bit different from what we see today, which is a much more Catholic
lowercase C.
Russian approach. But it is interesting that it is some of the same techniques of funding opposition groups and building ties with them. It's also something that Russia accuses other countries of doing to it and to its neighbors.
Yeah. And I mean, to be honest, this isn't just a Soviet phenomenon. I mean, this goes back even to the Tsarist Empire. When I was in grad school, one of the things did research on for my dissertation was looking at Austria and Russia's attempts to subvert one another through their cultivation of ethnic minority groups. So you've got, Russian money going to various, pro-Russian groups among the Ukrainian population living in Austria-Hungary. Meanwhile, Austria-Hungary is doing the same thing with Polish groups living in the Russian Empire. You can go through the archives and find records of payments from, the secret slush fund in the foreign ministry to these guys. You get occasional arrests of people smuggling weapons. I mean, this is an old story in some
ways. So the Soviets were trying to take down the master's house with the master's tools.
Kind of, yeah. Lenin himself was dispatched to the Soviet Union courtesy of the Germans.
But I think, and then the other piece of this that is interesting is the Western response to Russia, to Soviet Russia, which is on the one hand trying to subvert it and undermine it. Because even after the war thing stops being an issue, the Soviets have pulled out of the war, efforts to undermine Russia continue in part because the United Kingdom sees this as an opportunity. And if they can keep this country, which whoever rules it has historically been a rival, if they can keep it weak, why not? Yet at the same time, there's engagement. There's the response to the peace offensive. So mixed messages, right? That the West can't decide how it feels about Soviet Russia.
Yeah. And, some of the intervention forces that initially get involved to keep Russia in the war end up becoming participants in the war, fighting against the Bolsheviks. And, this is the British primarily, but also the Americans.
The Americans to a very small extent.
To a very small degree.
The American just enough contribution. Woodrow Wilson was actually somewhat sympathetic to the Bolsheviks.
Yeah. But there's just enough American intervention to feed this narrative in Russia that, you know, the Americans are in bed with the other imperialists. They're out to strangle the revolution right. in its cradle. And you also have this happening in Asia, by the way, with the Japanese, who are busy yes. trying to seize big chunks of territory Absolutely. In the Far East.
And I think what's also worth noting here is that these Western powers, many of them are arguing, many people in Western capitals are arguing that moderates will prevail, right? That the extremist Bolsheviks may have seized power, but eventually more moderate forces will prevail. But I wonder to what extent their intervention actually helps ensure that moderate forces don't prevail.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, again, this is the intervention allows the Bolsheviks to argue that it's the Western imperialist capitalist powers are trying to prevent Russians from having the government that they want. And it feeds into this kind of xenophobic response that then characterizes the way that the Soviet Union and to some degree modern Russia continue to look at the outside world.
We've been talking a lot about the foreign policy and foreign involvement aspects of the revolution, but I think it is it's also important to look inward. And, you know, while the Soviets became pragmatic in their foreign policy, you saw this strange ebb and flow of revolutionary ideas domestically, right? Mm-hmm. From we're going to eliminate marriage to, you know, we're going to make all children live together kind of in a giant national kibbutz. Well, that's what the kibbutz system is yeah. based on. I yeah. mean, you know, it's the way, you know, the way I put it is backwards, but that is the whole idea.
Right.
And it takes, you know, it takes a long time for the backlash against that to really have an effect and for Russia to sort of take a step back and say, okay, it's fine. You can, you know.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because in the 20s, you have this kind of revolutionary approach to culture, including, you know, things like family relationships and it's a moment of it's sort of when the avant-garde is at its peak in terms of Russian culture, when you've got people like, you know, Vladimir Mayakovsky and Alexander Blok and some of these other, you know, really cutting edge figures are sort of at the height of their influence and popularity.
You've got the cutting edge that's actually leading people, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to the cutting edge being somewhere off to the side,
right.
you know.
Yeah, they're not sort of this, you know,
they became,
oppressed
the
or
the cutting
ignored.
Edge becomes mainstream.
Right. But at the same time, in the early 20s, you've got a massive retreat from Bolshevik ideology on the economy, because this is the period of what's called the new economic policy, or NEP,
right.
which is kind of, okay, we tried the communist thing during the Civil War. It didn't work so well. We're going to allow a certain degree of private trade.
Well, it's the back and forth, right? And with foreign policy, economic policy, and social policy, you start off with very revolutionary ideas. Then you've got to dial them back. And
Except on the economic front, because once Stalin comes to power by the end of the 20s, then there's this, you know, real push for implementing communist ideas in the economy in a way that, you know, leads to the famine, the Holodomor in Ukraine, and collectivization, and everything else. Well,
which we talked about a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say that an important question to ask here is to what extent those were truly driven by communist ideology or other factors.
Yeah.
And I would argue other factors have an awful lot to do with it.
They have something to do with it. But I mean, if you read Stephen Kotkin's Stalin biography, I mean, he really emphasizes the point to it, the extent to which Stalin was a real ideologue. You know, he was a true believer, a revolutionary who thought that he was doing what, you know, the dictates of Marxism-Leninism demanded.
Though you need Leninism for that, right? Because Marxism didn't really think that much about the peasantry.
Well, yeah, Marxism didn't really have it didn't have a mechanism. It just sort of assumed that some of these things were going to happen, and Lenin kind of added the instrument by which it was to occur. But yeah, and you know, so even in the late 20s and early 30s, as you have this revolutionary approach to the economy and collectivization, you also have this massive cultural backlash where this avant-garde is now kind of driven out and persecuted, and you have the imposition of this very rigid sort of socialist realist aesthetic that comes to dominate Soviet culture for, you know, most of the rest of the Soviet period. So how revolutionary was the revolution?
It was very revolutionary. I mean, I think that that actually is, that's the bottom line, right? I mean, this, it changed everything. It certainly changed everything for Russia and other parts of Russian Empire, whether they ended up under Bolshevik rule in the near term, the long term, or never.
Yeah.
And it changed Europe.
Yeah, right. I was going to say it became the sort of key geopolitical development in Europe, really, for the rest of the 20th century. I mean, much of the rest of 20th century history was centered on the question of how do you respond to the rise of Bolshevism in Russia?
And not just for Europe, for Asia, and certainly for the United States.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, got to give Lenin and Trotsky and company their due. They changed the world.
Yeah, for good or ill, or both.
All right. Well, that does it for this revolutionary week. We have a link to Melissa's biography and her recent book, Mobilizing the Russian Nation, Patriotism and Citizenship in the First World War, in the show notes. Of course, our current event for this episode is a very non-current event. It's the anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution.
Well, the anniversary is current.
The anniversary is current, exactly. But let's see what happens over the next couple of weeks and see what we come back with to you for our next episode.
And, of course, if you aren't doing so already, please do consider subscribing to Russian Roulette on iTunes, where you can leave us a rating and a review. And spread the word. Tell all your friends. Tell random people you meet on the streets. And also, both you and the random people you meet on the streets should send us mailbag questions. We just did a mailbag episode, and now we need some more questions so that we can do another one. Send them to rep@csis.org with the words Russian Roulette in the subject line.
Don't forget to follow the program on Twitter. That's @CSIS Russia. And follow us on Twitter. I'm @Olya Olker, and Jeff is @DrJMankoff.
And of course, thank you, as always, to everybody who works so hard to make the podcast happen every 2 weeks. That includes our research assistant and program coordinator and producer, Cyrus Newland, our intern, Ia Tsaradze, and the whole CSIS External Relations and iLab team.
Thanks for listening.
Until next time.